On the Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business, and the economy. On the Money is broadcast from the studios of Radio 2SER and nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Elishina, and coming up on the program...
I can also remember all through my working career, my grandma asking me when they were going to make me full-time. And I had to explain that, A, there's no they. And also, like, full-time, there's none of that either.
The same sort of network of people got together to transform certain aspects of Australia's political and economic life.
When I got to 30 and I realised I had nothing behind me, I started to think about my long-term career prospects, how I was potentially going to fund my retirement. I've seen older people in my life closer to me getting to retirement age without as much as they should have, and that's pretty terrifying.
Welcome to our On the Money summer series. We featured some fantastic guests on the show in this past year, and in this summer series we have the rare opportunity to revisit some of these interviews and delve a little deeper into the issues discussed. Such as, what does the job market look like now? How are we coping with underemployment? How have we ended up with the economic policies that we have today? How can you build a business so you can sleep at night? And how do we actually crack the property market and get on that ladder? All this and more coming up on the Money. As we enter this new decade, we naturally begin to reflect on and reassess the past. In this installment of the On the Money summer series, we revisit the hot-off-the-press interview that started it all. In this extended cut, we speak with Dominic Kelly, Honorary Research Fellow at La Trobe University and author of Political Troglodytes and Economic Lunatics, about the origins of Australia's hard-right conservative movement. Where did these controversial ideas come from? Why have our economic policies shifted in such a significant way towards a US-inspired neoliberalism? And what can we expect in the future? This is an extended cut of Hot Off the Press, featuring exclusive new content about a very important topic. Dominic, tell us a little bit about the book. It was Prime Minister Bob Hawke that coined the term political troglodytes and economic lunatics, was it not?
That's right, yeah, back in 1986. So that was the year a group formed called the H.R. Nichols Society, which was devoted to transforming Australia's industrial relations system. So that and another three organisations is what I focused on in the book. Single-issue advocacy groups. The same network of people got together to transform certain aspects of Australia's political and economic life. And they really achieved a lot in their time.
And what led you to this particular research area, sort of the intersection of politics and economics?
I mean, this started as my PhD, and I had sort of grand plans about doing a somewhat of an intellectual history of Australia and looking at the different currents of thought since the Second World War. That was quickly shot down by my supervisor, who said that's far too big. So he thought that one way of approaching this sort of intellectual history was to focus on some groups that had plenty of attention in the media when they were active, but there was very little scholarly literature about them. And in terms of economics, I mean, the neoliberal transformation since the 70s and 80s in Australia has been as significant as anywhere in the world. The sorts of ideas that these guys were promoting back then, there's been a bit of a backlash in recent years against those ideas, but they were really dominant for a few decades. So it's an important way to get politics through this economic lens.
So you differentiated specifically in the book between the new right and the hard right.
Yeah, the new right is a term that's, well, naturally it's become obsolete because the new right no longer were new after they were around for a while. But that was the term that was used quite a lot in the 70s and 80s for these neoliberals. Neoliberalism was not a term that was really used in Australia at the time. It was a group of people linked to the Liberal Party that were really quite active. They were young. They were enthusiastic for new ideas. So they were moving away from the Menzies Liberal Party of a sort of staid traditional conservatism. They wanted sort of economic vigour. They wanted excitement. There's almost radicalism about them. But they became, this is the way things tend to happen, but they became more reactionary, more conservative. So that's why I use the term hard right for what they have become. But the new right was certainly how they were defined in the 80s.
And they drew a lot more influence from newer economic schools that were more hardline neoliberal. So, for example, they drew a lot on Milton Friedman's philosophies.
That's right. And Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises. So these are the godfathers of neoliberalism. And Friedman and Hayek both came out to Australia in the mid-70s and spoke at IPA events, Centre for Independent Studies events here in Sydney. They were the heroes that they were looking to. It was really a revolution within the economic sphere that we're still seeing the consequences of today.
You said they. There were three main figures.
Yeah. Hugh Morgan was an executive of Western Mining Corporation. He had an assistant called Ray Evans, probably the most significant figure in this book. Ray Evans was a culture warrior par excellence. He worked for Hugh Morgan at Western Mining. John Stone, the former Treasury Secretary and later a National Party Senator. They, among many others, but they were the key figures in these four groups that I was looking at.
And what made these men, as individuals and also together, so influential?
It really begins, I guess, with Ray Evans' almost singular capacity for activism. He was a devoted culture warrior until his death about 5 years ago. But he was not a well-known figure, so he needed the prominence of people like Hugh Morgan, a very well-known mining executive in his day, and John Stone, obviously very significant as a public intellectual, economist, politician. So the combination of their different talents and profiles was really important in achieving what they wanted to achieve.
You're listening to On the Money's summer series, featuring in-depth interviews and exclusive content from our Hot of the Press guests. I'm Veronica Alishina, speaking with researcher and author Dominic Kelly about the impact of hard right conservatism on Australian economic policy. And you're listening to us throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. And so you call in the book John Stone the enigmatic intellectual, and then Ray Evans, the corporate theologian, Hugh Morgan, the establishment rebel. And that kind of encapsulates their personalities and their roles in this.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, Hugh Morgan is the epitome of the old Melbourne establishment, old money, but he didn't really follow the rules of the old Melbourne establishment, which used to be a very liberal conservatism, a very moderate conservatism, but he took on that radical bent within it. Again, John Stone had this very traditional career through the public service and the Treasury, but didn't conform to the standards that you would normally expect of a senior Treasury official in terms of, you know, staying out of the political sphere, moderating his comments. That's why I call him a bit of an enigmatic intellectual.
He then moved into politics himself, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah, and became more and more radical, and is still published in the Financial Review letter section today, still very active in terms of his opinions. And Ray Evans, well, such a unique figure. I mean, almost a university activist, but worked his way into the corporate world, but used that role that he had with Hugh Morgan to encourage businesses to be more radical, to be more forthright in the public sphere, to fight for what they believed in, whether it was, you know, for the rights of miners, against the rights of environmentalists and Indigenous groups. A remarkable figure in that regard.
And one of the strategies that they used in order to kind of engage it with the public and engage with the establishment was the creation of think tanks. They were kind of the market of ideas for that.
Yeah, so Hugh Morgan was in touch with groups overseas, especially the UK in the 70s, and he learnt this lesson from them that individuals on their own can't achieve a lot. So to create organisations or support organisations, in his example with funds, he donated a lot of money to the Institute of Public Affairs and the Centre for Independent Studies. But even those think tanks for someone like Ray Evans weren't enough. So that's why he created these single issue advocacy groups like the H.R. Nichols Society, like the Samuel Griffith Society, the Bennelong Society, the Lavoisier Group. They felt that the think tanks, they had a research capacity, but they didn't have the same activist capacity that they could create on their own without any commitments to donors. They did exactly what they liked.
So out of those four advocacy groups that you mentioned, I'd like to focus on two, because this book is coming out at a very interesting time. It's election year. Yep. Here in Australia. So I wanted to talk about the H.R. Nichols Society, which focuses on industrial relations, and also on the Lavoisier Group, which focuses on climate change and climate science and stuff like that.
Yep.
So would you be able to tell me how these particular groups have impacted on not just the political ideology of the right, but on our economics in this country?
Yeah, so the H.R. Nichols Society came into being, as I said, in the 80s when the Hawke Labor government was in power. So it was very difficult for them to influence government policy at that time because they were their natural enemies. So they worked away on the Liberal opposition and tried to force moderates out and encourage hardline economic types to take those seats. And then by the time the Howard government came to power in 1996, there was a much more hardline Liberal Party, and they then used their influence to try and actually change government policy. They had difficulty doing that when it came to Workplace Relations Act because they needed to get it through the Senate, but still the Howard government did deliver some of what they wanted. When it comes to the sort of economic basis, I mean, this is what became a sort of economic orthodoxy, that we needed to privatise, deregulate, open the economy up to foreign investment. All of these sorts of things were orthodoxy for essentially three decades. As I said, there's now been a bit of a backlash, but it's that saying from Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. So people on the left found it very difficult, even though they were adamantly opposed to this, to really oppose it in a significant way that changed policy.
And also the language in which we talk about these different policies also keeps changing, doesn't it?
That's right. Yeah, so I mean, we used to talk about economic rationalism in Australia, a term that's again become obsolete, but that was a way of really making it very difficult to oppose. Why would you be opposed to something so rational as economic rationalism? Now that neoliberalism has become a bit of a dirty word in Australia, there is a much more significant opposition, I think, now, and especially once we've seen a lot of the negative consequences of these policies.
And also, I wanted to ask about the impact of and the relationship that these groups have with Keynesian economics, because the right, to some degree, used to embrace the role of government in establishing economic policy, in kind of managing the economy domestically. But now Keynesian economics is considered a dirty word to the hard right, whereas neoliberalism is considered a dirty word to anyone like centre and left.
Yeah, that's right. So again, this sort of link to the old Menzies liberalism, which was very Keynesian, very comfortable with government intervention in the economy. But, and that, sorry, I should add that the former head of the IPA, Charles Kemp, was a Keynesian. So the IPA was essentially a Keynesian organisation. But the new right rejected Keynes completely. And they were fortunate in that the economic crises of the 70s allowed their critique to have a lot of weight, because things weren't going well all of a sudden after the golden age of Keynesianism. So they rejected Keynes. They pushed out the old guard who were Keynesians. So even Charles Kemp, who ran the IPA on his own for three or four decades, his children, Rod and David Kemp, who both became Liberal MPs sort of pushed the old guard like their father and completely changed the direction of the organisation. Charles Kemp later wrote an article with the ironic title, Those Terrible 80 Years, where he critiqued this new hardline view where they said that Keynesianism has been a disaster. Well, he said, look at Australia's wonderful economic performance over the 20th century. It can't have been that bad.
Yeah, and in fact, we, under the Rudd government, they used elements of Keynesian economics to help lever Australia out of recession. Did they?
Yeah, so the economic stimulus package is a Keynesian measure.
You're listening to On the Money's summer series, featuring in-depth interviews and exclusive content from our Hot of the Press guests. I'm Veronica Alishina, speaking with researcher and author Dominic Kelly about the impact of hard right conservatism on Australian economic policy. And you're listening to us throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. And back to these groups that we were talking about, what is the end goal, both politically and economically speaking?
For the H.R. Nichols Society, they would like to see trade unions obliterated completely. They think that they only cause friction between employers and employees, which then does further damage to the economy. So if employers and employees could negotiate free of any middlemen, such as trade unions or the Fair Work Commission, then we would open the economy to more productivity, more success for everyone. When it comes to the Lavoisier group, well, they don't believe in climate science, so why would you spend money on climate science? So you can only do economic damage to the country by taking any action whatsoever on climate change, whether it's the weak action that we've seen from Liberal governments or the carbon tax from Labor and the Greens. All of it is damaging. So there's no compromise in that regard.
Right. So in terms of hard right, it's a very hard line approach.
That's right. Yeah. And that really comes from Ray Evans's personality. He's a no compromises, take no prisoners sort of political warrior.
And he was the speechwriter for Hugh Morgan.
Yeah, he wrote about 200 speeches for Hugh Morgan through the 80s and 90s. And they were always deliberately provocative. That's how you got media attention, by saying the most outrageous thing possible. And it worked.
Do you think there's a reflection of these strategies internationally?
I mean, obviously, Trump fits perfectly within that mold. I mean, he won the presidency by saying the most outrageous things. We all watched and thought, hey, he can't possibly do this. So perhaps Ray Evans was a early proponent of that and was seeing something that the rest of us couldn't. I mean, there is an idea that within democracies and the mainstream of democracies, that there are things that you can't say. Fraser Anning, we thought that he might be, you know, out of the realms of what you can say when he used the term final solution, but he has a certain amount of support.
And in the book, you write that these groups and these individuals on the sort of politico-economic spectrum sit somewhere between the National Party and the Liberal Party coalition and One Nation.
Yeah, so these terms can be slippery, but I don't describe them as far right or extreme right. I think all those terms are more useful for parties on the fringe, like One Nation, or whether it's the Australian Liberty Alliance, any of these sort of racist, Islamophobic groups. They're bordering on that with some of their rhetoric, but they tend to focus on economic issues and things like that. So that brings them closer to the Liberal and National parties in their sort of general policy preference. Having said that, John Stone and others in these groups have flirted with the idea that One Nation or Corey Bernardi's Australian Conservatives might be the best option for them in the future.
Oh, why do you think that is?
That was mostly a product of Malcolm Turnbull being Prime Minister, who they see as an inveterate lefty. So until the Liberal Party saw some sense and put in, whether it be Tony Abbott or Peter Dutton or even Scott Morrison, they were flirting with the idea of abandoning the mainstream parties altogether.
But Scott Morrison is appearing a little bit more pliable on certain issues.
Yeah. John Stone, I keep returning to him because he's the one who writes most frequently about day-to-day politics, doesn't trust Scott Morrison, but he thinks that things are somewhat back on track. He's pushed him on some immigration issues, and he thinks that there's been some progress.
So is there anything else that I haven't mentioned that you'd like to touch on?
Well, I know it's an economic-based show, but the Bennelong Society is a very significant group in that it tried to push Indigenous policy to a sort of mainstream economic view that unless Indigenous people join the mainstream economy, abandon their remote communities, give up on land rights, collective rights, anything like that, then they're doomed. And that really is a pretty alarming view to take, but it's a view that was very popular within Liberal Party circles, especially in the Howard years, and it continues to influence their policies towards Indigenous people.
So perhaps that's why we've seen so many cuts to Indigenous organisations and to support programs and things like that.
Yeah, it's a sort of laissez-faire view. If you can't support yourself economically, why should the government? That's the sort of bare bones of their view about Indigenous policy.
And so then coming out of that, welfare organisations or just our welfare support systems as well, I feel like that's very close to those kinds of policy stances.
Absolutely. And Gary Johns, who was a former Labor minister, but a significant figure in the Bennelong Society, wrote reports for the IPA about the charity sector, the non-governmental organisation sector, saying that they're all political activists and that their funds should be cut. And he's now head of the Australian Charities and Nonprofits Commission as a result of a Liberal government's appointment. So these things have flow-on effects even after the groups themselves have disbanded, as the Bennelong Society has.
So which groups are now still active then?
So the Bennelong Society is the only one of the four that's formally disbanded. The Samuel Griffith Society is the only one that's going along fairly strongly. The H.R. Nichols Society and Lavoisier Group essentially run as blogs and Facebook pages, but have no real capacity to do anything other than the occasional post. But the Lavoisier Group doesn't really need to continue because there are so many other climate denial groups for people to join. The Samuel Griffith Society is really the only one left of any significance.
Yeah, and we haven't touched on that one yet. So
that's probably the driest of the four. It's devoted to constitutional issues, federalism being its major bugbear, the decline of federalism in Australia and the centralisation of power in Canberra. But most significantly, in the 90s, it was adamantly opposed to the Mabo judgment and to an Australian republic. They thought that the Mabo judgment was going to lead to economic catastrophe, proved to be wrong, and they fought the republic and were successful, along with many other groups that fought the republic.
So the IPA, for example, is that kind of an extension of some of these groups? What have they changed into and over
time? IPA is probably the foundation more than the extension of these groups, but they're very linked. So the IPA goes back to the 40s and provided a lot of the personnel for these groups. It and the Centre for Independent Studies are now the two most prominent think tanks on the right, where young people, for example, would go if they wanted to promote right-wing policies beyond the party system.
How influential are these groups now?
The four initial groups or the think tanks?
The think tanks themselves now.
Yeah, I have a somewhat conflicted view on this. I mean, the IPA get an enormous amount of media attention, especially from the ABC. So they really do benefit from the fact that the ABC needs to find balanced panels and different guests. But their policy influence, I think, has waned in recent years. They had a huge push on repealing 18C. It was almost their sole issue for a couple of years there. And they failed because they just simply do not have the support of the Australian people. And the Liberal Party has to back off on issues where they cannot either get it through the parliament or get some significant community support. So all the media attention in the world doesn't necessarily translate into policy change.
Absolutely. And just one thing that I want to touch on as well. It was interesting to me to read about how the political views of these people shifted and changed over time. So was there a common catalyst, would you say, that drove these people further to the right? Or was it just the people that they were around? Or
I think there's an element of once you set up these networks that things tend to radicalize, that you can push each other further, especially when you have a leader like Ray Evans, who pushed his acolytes to go further and further to the right. I mean, in recent years, there have been a number of catalysts for sort of radicalization. So, you know, 9/11 obviously pushed people further to the right when it came to Islam and Islamophobia. The financial crisis rather bizarrely pushed some of them further to the right on deregulation, almost learning the opposite lesson that most people would think from a banking crisis caused by liberalization of markets. So, yeah, I mean, there is an element within these circles, always finding the most hardline view and the view that will upset the left as much as possible. Trolling the left seems to be a big reason for being these days on the right.
That was Dominic Kelly, Honorary Research Fellow at La Trobe University and author of Political Troglodytes and Economic Lunatics, speaking to us about the impact of the hard right movement on Australia's politico-economic landscape. You're listening to On the Money's summer series featuring in-depth interviews and exclusive content from our hot of the press guests. I'm Veronica Elishina, and you're listening throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. And that's all we have time for on the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business, and the economy. Special thanks to our executive producer, Roderick Chambers. On the Money is produced in the studios of 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all our shows and stories at 2SER.com/onthemoney. I'm Veronica Elishina. We will be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Thanks for your company.
We never know what is coming tomorrow.